Mechanics is just the number of degrees of freedom is infinite. And so perturbation theory there is the usual quantum mechanical perturbation theory. However, it's typically recast in a form that's not taught in the courses in quantum mechanics. Because, well, in field theory, the spectrum is, first of all, it's continuous because particles can have arbitrary energy, and then it's very degenerate. So there are many, many degenerate states. And this brings in some complications if you try to apply the usual rules of, I don't know, secular perturbation theory for energy levels. It's not very useful in the field theory context. So one reformulates it in a different way, which applies to any quantum mechanical systems, but, well, usually one can do with, in quantum mechanics, one can do with simpler methods. And so, anyway, it's perhaps not very familiar to you. So, so we'll do some technical developments, and let me start with the notion of time ordering. So suppose we want to solve the Schrödinger equation. But with the Hamiltonian that depends on time. So this is the Schrödinger equation for the evolution operator. So U is describes quantum evolution from time t prime to time t. So the boundary conditions is that at the initial moment the operator is equal to 1, and we want to solve this equation. Now we know the solution when where the Hamiltonian is time independent. Then the solution is the exponent, so it's equal to e to the minus I h t minus t prime. But this is only when h doesn't depend on time. Now I'll show that the solution can always be written as an exponential, but this exponential is contains time ordering operation. So how does it work? Well, in general, if we cannot solve this equation generally for arbitrary h of t, but we can at least rewrite it as an integral equation. So let's integrate both parts of the equation from t prime to t, and then on the left-hand side we will have u of t, t prime, which will be equal to 1. This is the constant of integration that you know from the boundary conditions. And then minus I integral from t prime to t d tau h of tau u of tau t prime. Okay, so one can check that this differentiation of this equation returns back the original equation from which we started. So it's just another form of this equation, an integral form. But in this form, we can easily find an approximate solution by doing iterations. So we can start, we can say that, okay, iterative solution is basically the solution when we treat the Hamiltonian, the whole Hamiltonian as perturbation. So to the leading order, we can say that u is equal to 1. So zeroth iteration gives u equal 1. And then we simply substitute it to the right-hand side instead of u under the integral. So on the first iteration, we get that u of t prime is equal to 1 minus I integral from 0 from t prime to t d tau u of h of tau. And then we can do second perturbation, second iteration. So yes, actually second iteration is still interesting. So first of all, if we substitute, now we need to substitute this expression for u. And so what do we get? We get the same term. But then we get also a term which is plus minus I squared integral from t prime to tau. So this comes from the 1. And then when I substitute this, I can write this as d t1, h of t1, and then times integral. So you see that here, to find u of t, we integrate up to t. Right? So here, when we substitute it here, we should integrate up to tau, which is the integration variable in the integral. So we relabeled tau to be tau 1. So the second integration starts with tau prime but goes up to t1. And then we have h of t2. So now it's clear how the series should look like. So each time we add another term, we have a nested series of integrations, such that the integration over the next point in time extends to the previous integration point. So if this is time, we have our starting point t prime, then the end point t. And so we integrate over first point. So we integrate, the first point is integrated over the whole interval, t1. Then the second point is integrated from t prime to t2, t1. And sure enough, if we go to higher orders in perturbation theory, to higher iterations, we'll simply have more and more points here, all of them ordered in this particular way, so that the next integration goes between the initial point and the integration point of the previous iteration. So the iterative solution can be written as formal series. So we can write it as a series from 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n. And then this nested integral. Now, so here it is very important that h is not a function, it's an operator. So various h's do not necessarily commute at different points of time. And in this representation, the product is ordered in a way that is correlated with the moments of time at which these operators appear. So you see that to the right we have the operator that has the smallest argument, and then so they're time ordered. They are ordered along with their time arguments. So therefore we can introduce the operator of time ordering. So if you have two operators that depend on time, so for example, that can be Heisenberg operators, some Heisenberg operators, then we define their time ordered product in the following way. So this is equal to the product of operators in the same order if t1 was later than t2, or otherwise we should interchange their order. So this is just a definition, and for arbitrary number of operators, generalization is obvious. Then we can insert the time ordering here, and then we can extend integration in this formula to the whole interval for each point. I'll explain what I mean. So we can now integrate from t prime to t for t1 and for all other points as well. And here we should insert the time ordering. Symbol. So what did I do? So here you see that the operators are time ordered automatically. Yes?
I don't seem to understand the relationship between the last line and then the second line and then this. Yes.
So I take one and substitute here for you. Mm-hmm. Right? So what I get is the same equation, so I say that u is equal to that, but then I approximate expression for u is just 1. So here we don't have u at all, and I have some approximation for the exact solution. Now if I want to improve this approximation, I take this line and substitute it for u. So then we gain this second term. And then if I repeat it many times, I get this
formula. Then you said that if h is independent of time, and then we are integrating in terms of time, yeah, I don't know which time we are.
Oh, okay, so this is false. So when h is independent of time, we have this formula. So this formula is true when h is average. So the whole point here is that to derive some analog of this formula for the case where h is time dependent. Okay. So here is this. Here we the product of Hamiltonians is time ordered because of the structure of
this nested structure of integration. Here it is ordered explicitly, but the integrations are unconstrained. Okay, so the relation between the two is that, well, if the points are nested in the correct way, so that T1 goes last, Tn goes first, and then in between they are ordered in the right way, then we don't need the time ordering here, and we go back to this formula. But this is only one of all possible n factorial permutations of the points. And so time ordering makes sure that each permutation produces the same result. But to not to overcount, we need to divide by n factorial. So we write it this way. But then you see that we can write it So we can write it as sum over n minus I to the n over n factorial. And then, okay, so formally we can take the time ordering symbol out of the integral. And then the integral becomes a product of identical integrals. H of tau raised to the power n. Okay. So at first, so what does this expression mean? I should write this nth power as explicit product of n integrals. So written here, right? And then under the integral, I should time order the operators. But then I can further take out T from the sum, and the sum becomes the exponential. So this is the Taylor expansion of the exponential, of the exponential function. And finally, we can write that the evolution operator is the t exponent of minus I integral from t prime to t d tau h of tau. So this is the final result. So this is a formal solution to our problem. In practice, this is just a compact way to write this iterative perturbative solution. Because of the two ordering, we really need to expand, and then two ordering tells us how the operators are ordered under the integrals. But anyway, so there is a compact way to write down the result of time-dependent perturbation theory. This is, yes?
How we know that we can, that we're allowed to time order the functions? Like, why are we allowed to do that?
It's just a matter of definition. So this is a definition. So it tells us that if you have a product of two operators that just time ordering brings them, so they don't come here. The time order tells us that we should write them in such an order that time grows from right to left. This is how it stands here. So here the time goes from right to left by definition, by the way. So this equation we derived by solving the Schrödinger equation. And time ordering there is automatic. Now, so this is just a way, this is the rewriting of this formula where we want to impose the ordering operator by hand. But the gain is that we now can unconstrain our integration. So anyway, so this is just a way to write down this formula. So so you see that when we are dealing with the perturbation theory in quantum mechanics, so this is a typical problem, the problem of solid Schrödinger equation for Hamiltonian that depends on time is a typical problem in quantum mechanics that the writers when time-dependent perturbation theory. And so this is a way to write a compact expression for the evolution operator. Now, time ordering here is very important, so it arises naturally with the solid iterations. So there is a natural object that one can study in quantum mechanics and quantum mechanics, but in particular quantum field theory. And these objects are called Green's functions. So usually quantum mechanics, what do we want to compute? Well, compute some probabilities. Quantum mechanics is the science of probabilities. We want to compute, we usually can compute an amplitude of some physical process. The square of this amplitude is the probability, or we compute the probability of a particle to be at some particular point or have some particular momentum. So the same you can do in quantum field theory, but somehow it's simpler to begin with different objects. So instead of doing that, we will start with some correlation functions. So this will be, we can also study in quantum mechanics, we can also study, okay, averages. So of some operators in our quantum state. So if we want to find what is the average value of some physical quantity in a given state, we just compute so that the physical quantities are correspond to operators, and we can compute the average of the of some operator in a given state. Now, Green's functions are these particular averages taken in the ground state, but with the time of the time ordered products of the Heisenberg operators. So, in field theory, when we quantize, the field itself becomes the Heisenberg operator, so we can take the time-ordered product of field operators and average them in the ground state. And this is called the Green's function. So the definition is following. So if we take so the Green's function is the ground state expectation value of the time-ordered product of field operators. So by omega, I denote here the ground state.
For free fields, the ground state is just the empty state. But in general, for interacting fields, the ground state need not be empty. It contains some particles. So this is the definition of the Green's function. Now, in fact, it is possible. So usually we want, again, in quantum mechanics, the basic quantities that one can compute. Yes.
The ground state has the one that is described by the particle, the operators of the stray particle, right? So how do we define the ground state for the interactive field theories?
What's the lowest standard state of
the field? Yes. And it's not the same.
And it's not the same. In fact, they are never the same. So, relativistic field theory, the ground state cannot coincide with the state. Okay, so any question that we may ask, for instance, what happens to energy levels on the field theory that they are not similar question will be what happens to particle masses, how they change when we switch on the direction, or how to describe some scattering processes, they can all be addressed with the help of the Green's function. So if you know all the Green's functions, you know everything about field theory, which is certainly not obvious. And I think I will not have time to explain how to extract physics from the Green's functions. So let's say that we studied it just because perturbation theory for the Green's functions is really the simplest one. And then we'll see how to generalize it to more physically with quantities that are more direct physically than amplitudes. So let's start with, actually let's start with free fields. So let's compute the Green's functions of a free Klein-Gordon field. Temporarily neglect interactions. And we would like to be able to calculate these averages over the ground state. Now, the ground state is the empty state. Phi's, we know the expansion of phi's in terms of oscillators. And so basically, this becomes a problem of computing averages of some linear combinations of oscillation, of harmonic oscillator operators. There is a way to streamline this calculation, and this is called the Wicks theorem, and this is one of the most important results in quantum field theory. The reason that I'd like to spend some time on this free field Green's functions is that in interacting theory, we can reduce the problem to free fields. So it is important to understand how, for free fields, we compute this Green's function. So the simplest example is the two-point function. And it has so important, it is so important in quantum field theory that it even has its own name. So it's called the propagator.
So this, the propagator, well, what is the meaning of this Green's function? Well, we can think of, so suppose that x, so x and y are such that y stands at earlier time. Then what happens is that psi of y, so it stands to the right of psi of x, so it contains some creation operators. Actually, it's linear creation operators, so it creates a particle by acting on the ground state. And then phi of x annihilates this particle because it's sandwiched with the ground state. So this describes a particle created at point x, and then it propagates at point y, and then it propagates over to point x. Okay. Now, if the time order is interchanged, then psi of x tends to the right, and then it creates a particle, and psi of y annihilates it. So the propagator describes this elementary process of particle creation and annihilation. There is a source pinned down to point y that creates a particle, it propagates, and then it is being annihilated. So the propagator is the quantum mechanical amplitude for this process. And for this picture, we'll use a lot these pictures to depict particle creation and annihilation. So we will indeed just denote the propagator by this line that connects y and x. So how to calculate this the amplitude? Well, there are two ways. One way is to express phi and x in terms of oscillators, and then so this will be a very simple expectation value of one creation, one annihilation operator. So we need then just to pick up the coefficients, and this will give the answer. Now there is another way which I find kind of instructive, and this exploits the fact that phi of x satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. So we know that the field operator is a solution, the quantum field operator is a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. So we can take the Green's function. So the Green's function depends only on the difference between x and y. Because of translational invariance. So we can set y to 0 and then deal with the Green's function that depends on x. So then we can act by the Klein-Gordon operator on d of x. So that would act on psi of x, give 0, and so on the right-hand side it seems that we'll get 0. In fact, there are some anomalous terms that we miss in this simple, well, simple-minded calculation. These are called Schwinger terms. Indeed, so the right-hand side is not completely zero. The reason why it happens is that when we differentiate, we differentiate in per, so d squared contains also time derivatives. And time derivatives, they act not only on the operator, but also on the time ordering. The time ordering contains, it contains explicit dependence on time. So, indeed, if you write a product of two operators and time order them, then we can write it as theta of x 0, phi of x, phi of 0, and then plus theta of minus x 0, phi of 0, phi of x. Right? So if the time coordinate, the time argument of phi is positive, then time ordering tells us that phi of x should stand to the left of phi of 0. And vice versa, if it's negative, then phi of 0 has larger time argument. So when we differentiate in time, we should not only differentiate phi, but we should also differentiate the theta function. So, indeed, T0 of theta function is equal to the delta function, right? So the derivative of the step function is the delta function. And that should be taken into account when we apply the Klein-Gordon operator to the time order product. So let's calculate what we get. So the important part of the Klein-Gordon operator is the part that contains time derivatives. So it's time derivative squared acting on this product becomes what? So there will be three terms. So one term is when the derivative acts on psi. Okay, so it does not touch the theta functions. So both derivatives. And this is the term that contains the derivative under the time ordering symbol. Then there will be two terms where one of the derivatives acts on the theta function. This gives us delta of 0. And then what's left can be written as the conjugate momentum commuted with phi of 0. I'll explain why. And finally, there's the term where both derivatives act on the delta function. And this contains a commutator of phi of x with phi of 0. So the commutators arise because, okay, when we differentiate an x0, so you see that here the argument is minus x0, so we get a minus sign here, and basically we get the commutator. And delta of x is equal to delta of minus x. Also, we use the fact that here we use the fact that d0 phi is equal to pi. This is one of the Heisenberg equations of motions. Now, let's look at this term. So first of all, it multiplies delta function of x of 0. So here, you see that we can replace the time. So this delta of 0 actually restricts this commutator to the... So this makes this commutator equal time commutator because the argument of the pi also becomes, the time argument also becomes 0. And so at 0, the Heisenberg operators and the Schrodinger operators do not differ. So this is a commutator of two Schrodinger operators, so momentum and coordinate. And this gives just the delta function because they are canonically conjugate to one another. We can write that pi of 0x commutator with phi of 0 is basically, so pi with pi is equal to minus I delta of x. Yes?
Here, when doing the derivative, we we'll take the derivative of the heavy hat theta to give us delta, but we're taking the second derivative, right?
Yes.
So what's the second derivative of the heavy hat? Like, what's the derivative of delta?
Come to that. I just want to explain this. So, okay, so here, well, if you do the same, so if we say that, okay, this commutator is restricted to the zero time slice of space time, then this is an equal time commutator of phis, and they commute. They are like x or q commuting this q, which is zero. But then we would have made a mistake, because we should actually expand phi of x to the leading order in the Taylor series in time. So this would be phi of 0 x plus the first time derivative, which is phi. Plus something for second order in time. And then, okay, so the correct definition of the second derivative of the Heaviside function is that it is equal to its product with x0 should be equal to the delta function itself. So x0 delta x0 d0 delta of x0 is actually the same as minus delta of x0. So one can check that by integrating it with an arbitrary probe function. And doing integration by parts, one gets this equation. So one can write it that way. So after substituting this here, so the first term doesn't contribute. The second term gives the same commutator. And finally, what we get is that the Schwinger term. So let's see. So this would combine with, this will combine with the rest of the Klein-Gordon operator and kill this field because it satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. And these two terms give the Schwinger term. And so finally we say that the Schwinger term is equal to, okay, so it contains delta of x, 0, and then delta of x vector with the coefficient that's equal to minus 2i, and then there is another term coming from here with the coefficient that's equal to plus I. So at the end we will have minus I delta of x0 delta of x vector, and this is just a four-dimensional delta function. So this is minus I delta of x, or this is a four-dimensional delta. So finally, we see that the propagator satisfies the following equation. I delta of x. Which we can solve. So if we do Fourier transform, then d becomes minus ip. And so this becomes an algebraic equation. The delta function, the Fourier image of the delta function is 1.
So we get a simple algebraic equation which we can solve. So in the momentum space, the propagator is a simple algebraic function. This is an important formula that will be used all over the place, and it's used all, I mean, it's very widely used in quantum field theory.
Does the time ordering lead to plus minus epsilon in the denominator, or the time ordering essentially gives us a boundary condition on the Green's function, right?
Time ordering, well, it has sort of, it means two things. So, first of all, because with time order, we get the Schwinger term.
Right.
This is the reason why we put the Schwinger term. Secondly, it also imposes certain boundary conditions. Indeed, that's a good point. This is an equation. This is a second order differential equation. So it needs boundary conditions. Specify what boundary conditions we impose here. So it seems that after Fourier transform, we lose this information because the solution seems unique. What goes wrong here? How come that we found the unique solution to the equation that requires two arbitrary functions to specify the problem?
Yeah, but when you Fourier transform, you're assuming some behavior of the function that you transform.
Yes, that's correct.
So we assume some certain behavior of the function back.
Yes,
that's
true. That's certainly true. So what happens is if I want to Fourier transform back, I will see what goes wrong. So if you want to compute the Green's function on X representation, so we should integrate it with E.
And then apparently we run into trouble because the integral, strictly speaking, it diverges because there is a pole of integration that lies on the integration axis. However, this pole is precisely the consequence of imposing the boundary conditions. So poles of this type, of course, are easy to get rid of or easy to regularize. We have to simply tell how, so we should shift the contour a little bit by an epsilon, and then the integral will be fine. So it's convenient to think of the poles as arising in the energy integration plane. So this is the plane of complex energies, but we integrate over the real axis. And then there are two poles in the integrand at square root of p, let me write it as energy of the particle minus the energy of the particle. E of p is p squared plus m squared. Okay, so we have two poles on shell.
Denominator explicitly, so we can see where the
false P0 squared. Yes, okay. Yeah, sure. So P squared minus M squared is P0 squared minus P squared minus M squared. So if P0 is equal to the square root of P squared plus M squared, then certainly there's a pole. But since P squared enters with the square, then the sign doesn't matter, so two poles. And then, okay, so the contour of integration. So in between the integration points, it should go along the rail axis. And then we should tell how to encircle the poles. And basically, the ambiguity here is precisely the one that we have in the boundary conditions. So we need to prescribe two functions that come from the residue of this pole. So this is the reason that these poles arise. Is precisely because the equation is of the same second order, and we need the boundary conditions to impose. Okay, so but when we compute the propagator, the boundary conditions are actually fixed, so they are
they correspond to encircling the antiparticle pole from below and the particle pole from above. So at the moment I cannot explain why the boundary conditions are dead. So these are called this is called Feynman prescription or Feynman corresponds to Feynman boundary conditions in the propagator. Later we will see that this prescription corresponds to picking up the correct vacuum, so that we do perturbation theory on top of the right ground state with the lowest energy. At the moment, let's take it just as given. So this is a prescription that we use. So this pole prescription corresponds to adding a small imaginary shift to the whole denominator. So this epsilon prescription just tells us that we should encircle the poles in a certain way. Yes?
I don't understand. Like if you are computing just a real integral, right, that means that you have to compute just a real integral using like residue method calculation.
Then the poles lie on the relaxed.
Yes, the poles will lie on the relaxed. The only thing that you would have to see is there from if you could close the counter integration on the upper half plane, on the lower half plane, and that would totally define how we should do the counter. So why here do we have this ambiguity?
Oh, absolutely, you're right. So once we have this contour, then we know, so we can close it. So you see that so this exponent determines when we can close the contour in the upper or in the lower plane. So we should close the contour in such a way that the exponential is decaying in this plane. So essentially, it determines determined by the sign at zero. If we have a particular contour, then this particular sign is at zero, we can close the contour and we'll get such and such particular result. So the choice of the contour, therefore, determines the behavior of the propagator at plus or minus infinity in time. So it precisely determines the boundary conditions. If you choose the contour differently, the function will behave differently at plus or minus infinity, and therefore that will correspond to different boundary conditions. So one can formulate, one can start with imposing boundary conditions, the behavior of this function, say, at plus infinity and minus infinity, and then figure out the contour. So I think this is how Feynman did it. Uh, way to see it is to do explicit calculation with oscillators that has no ambiguities. And then one can see that this gives the result that corresponds to this particular contour. And the third way show the next lecture is to impose the condition that the ground state is the state of the lowest temperature.
Okay, so we managed to compute the two-point Green's function of free fields. Doesn't look like much, but this is actually the most difficult step. The rest is combinatorics. So we can reduce the problem of computing any Green's function for arbitrary, so first for free fields and then for interacting fields, just a combinatorial problem where the main building block is the propagator, the Green's function of the free field. So this can be, for the free field, the statement is known as the Weak's theorem, named after Italian physicist Wick. The idea is the following. So suppose you have some product like that. So you have some expression that contains creation operators and annihilation operators. So here this denotes that they have some coefficients, but it really doesn't matter to us at the moment what coefficients are. So how do we compute this expression? We know that annihilation operators kill the ground state. So, for instance, we can immediately cross this oscillation operator. And then creation operators, when acting on the left, the cat vacuum, they annihilate they annihilated, so we can cross that one. Now in the middle, there will be some creation operators. So for instance, this annihilation operator to figure out, to get rid of it, we need to pull it through the whole expression. And then we can interchange its order with other creation operators by using economical commutation relations, and once we reach the ground state, we can eliminate it. Okay, so the strategy is to pull through all creation operators to the left and annihilation operators to the right. The procedure is called normal ordering. So this is so let me give an example. How do we normal order it? Normal order. Suppose we have oscillator A1, A2, Tegger A3. Then what should we do? We need to take this oscillator and put it to the right of A2, and then it will be normal order. So then we can write this as a commutator of A1, A2, plus the same expression, but written in the normal ordered form. Sorry, I should pick keep the A3. So we see that this expression is already normal ordered. So we can write it as the commutator of A1 is A2, A3, plus normal ordered expression. Now we can do the same with the field operators because they have precisely this form, the linear combinations of creation and annihilation operators. We can write the field operator as a sum of two pieces, x plus and x minus, where plus contains only annihilation operators and minus contains only creation operators. So explicitly we can write that phi plus of x is d 4 pi over 2 pi to the 4 2 pi delta of pi squared minus m squared theta of pi 0 square root of 2 pi 0 and then e to the minus I p x a p. So phi minus is the same, but with the creation operators. So let's repeat this calculation of the two-point function, now using this direct brute force calculation. So if you have the product of two fields, okay, then we write them as product of, so we expand them in positive and negative frequency parts. Let's assume also that x0 is larger than y0. Okay, then we can, they are already ordered in the right way. And so we just expand this as phi plus of x, phi plus of y, plus phi minus of x, phi plus of y, plus phi plus of x, phi minus of y, phi minus of x, phi minus of y. Then what we want to do is we want to put all phi minuses to the left, right? So then we see that this term is normal ordered. So phi minuses should be to the left. This term is normal ordered. This term is normal ordered. This one is not. So we should compute a commutator here. So we add the commutator phi plus of x, phi minus of y, plus the normal ordered product. Phi of x, phi of y. Now, if x0 is smaller than y0, then the time order product will be the same with the with x and y interchange. So then we should have put the y field to the left. So we'll get the commutator of phi plus of y, phi minus of x, plus the normal order product. And then we can introduce pairing, the operation of pairing. So basically we call the leftover here, we call pairing, the commutator term. And we can write it in a uniform way if we so make the pairing remember the time order. So and this will be equal to the commutator of phi plus of x phi minus of y if x 0 is larger than y 0 and phi plus of y phi minus of x otherwise x 0 smaller than y 0. So then we can write these two formulas in a uniform way, so that the t product of phi x phi y is equal to the pairing plus time ordered product. It's called also
a contraction. Yeah,
and it's also called the property. So now it's there is an obvious statement that if you have an operator and you normal order it, and this will give you zero unless operator is a C number. Right? Because if it contains at least one creation and annihilation operators, because of normal ordering, they will either annihilate the right or the left vacuum, so we'll get zero. So in particular, if you take the vacuum expectation value, so if you break it, so let's apply, let's take an expectation value of this equation in the ground state. Then on the left-hand side, we'll get the Green's function, which is the propagator, right? On the right-hand side, we will have two terms. So this is normal order. This will give zero. And this, actually, this will be a C number. Because you see, this psi plus and psi minus, they contain just one creation annihilation operator. So if you commute, the commutator of creation annihilation operators gives a C number value delta function. So we get some function that depends on x and y. So we find that pairing is simply equal to the propagator, or the propagator is equal to pairing. So they're just equal to one another. So now let me formulate the theorem. So Wick's theorem states that
The t-order product of arbitrary number of fields is equal to normal order product plus all possible contractions. Possible weak contractions. So the theorem can be proven by induction. I have simply no time to prove it. Let me just give an example. So suppose that we have three operators. Phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. So this is a shorthand notation for phi of x1, phi of x2, phi of x3. So this will be equal to phi of phi 1, phi 2, phi 3 without pairings plus phi 1 can pair with phi 2 plus phi 1 can pair with phi 3. And plus phi 2 can pair with phi 3. So this can be read as follows. So the normal ordered expressions are left as they are. And then pairings are just replaced by propagators, which are C number functions, so they can be taken out of the operator expression. So this will be D1, 2, phi 3 normal ordered plus D1, 3, phi 2 normal ordered plus D2, 3, phi 1 normal ordered. Also, this theorem has a corollary which allows to compute the Green's function using this contraction technique. So so the Green's functions of the free field are given by summing over all possible contractions. So the reason is that, okay, when we sandwich this expression in the vacuum, on the left-hand side, we get the Green's function. Now, any terms where we have any fields left will go to zero because of this. So the only terms that will survive are maximally contracted, so the C number expressions where we have all possible contractions. So here there are no such terms, right, because we are always left with one, at least one field. So the number of fields should be even for the Green's function to not to vanish. So here, this will be this unique term with one single contraction. So for example, if you compute the four-point Green's function, so then, okay, so there will be three inequivalent contractions, right? This one, this one, and then this one. Like that. This can be written, this is just a product of propagators. 1, 4, D2, 3 plus D1, 4, 1, 3, 2, 4, 1, 4, 2, 3. So you see that Wick's theorem allows one to express any Green's functions in terms of two-point Green's functions. And also, we can write it as a picture. So if you have 4 points, then you can simply connect them in three possible ways. One, three, or four, like that, and like that. So this is the simplest example of the Feynman diagram. This is the simplest examples of Feynman diagrams. So Feynman diagrams are simply pictures that we draw with propagators. Yes? So this commutation stuff is behind this scene now. So this Wick theorem just streamlines all these commutations that we need to do. We just draw this contraction. Contraction is the result of these commutations. But due to Wick's theorem, we just draw all possible contractions. And that's it. So this phi 1 contracted with phi 2 is simply the propagator from going from 1 to 2. So the prescription is that you write all possible contractions, then replace each contraction by a propagator, and you get the analytic expression for the Green's function.
So
that's
possible
to prove. Yes, so the proof, so this, the way that you deal with oscillators is in the proof, but resultatively this is just this prescription anyway, and then one can draw this as a picture. Okay, I stop here. That's it for today.